I appreciate the fact that this day has been given over to a study of this very crucial topic. And it is an honor and a pleasure for me to be here and study this topic with you. My assignment is 1 Corinthians 7, 1 through 16. And I want to try to say exactly what the text says, no more and no less. First, I want to give a comprehensive view of what I understand these verses to be saying, and then look at them in more detail. The first section, verses 1 through 7, corrects a misconception the Corinthians had of marriage. They had a low view of marriage, and Paul corrects it. In the second section, verses 8 through 9, there is the application of verses 1 through 7 to the unmarried and widows in Corinth. Verses 10 through 11, Paul repeats the substance of the Lord's word on divorce and marriage, the word he gave during his public ministry, for instance, Matthew 19, and applies that word to Corinth. In 12 through 16, Paul deals with mixed marriages, that is, the marriage of a pagan and a Christian. And the question the Corinthians asked was, can a Christian remain married to a pagan? Wouldn't it be defiling for a Christian to remain married to a pagan? And Paul answers, no, it is not. On the contrary, the pagan is sanctified by the Christian, and your children are clean rather than unclean. So he says, you remain married. Now, this is a problem that our Lord had no occasion to deal with during his ministry. And that is what Paul means when he says, this is what I say, not the Lord. The contrast is not between the authoritative word of the Lord and Paul's mere opinion. The contrast is rather between what the Lord said during his ministry and what he said through Paul. And both the apostolic ruling of Paul and the word of the Lord are equally inspired and equally the word of God. Now, to go back and look at it in more detail, in 1 through 7, Paul corrects the Corinthian misconception of marriage. Concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. This is what the Corinthians said. This is not Paul's word, but the word of the Corinthians. The Corinthians mean, it is good for a man not to be married, or if he's married, to live as a celibate within the marriage. Paul often, or rather I should say, Paul on more than one occasion quotes from what the Corinthians were saying to him. For example, in 6:12, he says, all things are lawful. It's apparent from what follows that this is not what Paul is urging upon the Corinthians. It is what the Corinthians were parroting to Paul and to one another. All things are lawful. All things are lawful. But Paul shows at once that it is not the case that all things are lawful. He first shows that this lacks balance, even in the sphere in which it applies. That is, in the Corinthian understanding, it lacks balance. And then he corrects the Corinthian misunderstanding of the maxim altogether. It's not applied to everything. As stated here, it is not true. And Paul disagrees. In chapter 8, verse 1, concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know, because we all know. We know because we all have knowledge. Paul, ironically, is quoting the Corinthians, who were sure they knew the solution already. In chapter 10, 23, again, Paul quotes what the Corinthians were saying and corrects their misconception. All things are lawful, all things are lawful. Now, it is apparent in 1 Corinthians 7, 1 through 7, that Paul disagrees with this statement. It is good for a man not to touch a marriage. Not only is it apparent here that he disagrees, but it's apparent from what Paul says elsewhere about marriage. In Ephesians 5, 22 through 33, Paul pictures the ideal relationship between the husband and wife. That ideal relationship is pictured in the relationship between Christ and the church. That's an exceedingly high view of marriage. 1 Timothy 3:2, Paul says that the elders must be married. 3:12, he says deacons must be married. 1 Timothy 4:3, those who forbid marriage are not put in a good light by Paul. They are led astray by seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. 1 Timothy 5:14, Paul says, he desired that the younger women marry, bear children, rule the house. I cannot believe that Paul is saying it is better here for a man not to be married, or if married, to live as a celibate. But it's apparent from this context itself that Paul disagrees. In verse 2 he says, but, that is contrastive. It already means disagreement. But, in opposition to what you say, because of the prevalent fornications, let each one have his own wife. The let each one have is an imperative, third person singular. It's not mere permission, it is an imperative. To avoid the prevalent fornications, each one should have his own wife. And each woman should have her own husband. Let the husband render to the wife her due. And Paul does not mean here benevolence which is due her, but he means conjugal rights, the rights that belong exclusively to marriage, and likewise also the wife to the husband. He does not believe that a man should remain celibate in marriage. He is disagreeing vigorously, fundamentally. The woman does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another. This is a present imperative. It means the Corinthians were doing it, and Paul says, you are to stop it. Stop living as celibates in the interest of a higher spirituality. The reason the Corinthians were doing this was their wrong worldview. There was a pagan worldview which said that the body is the tomb of the soul, or the body is the prison house of the soul. The body and its functions, therefore, are less than honorable, if not downright evil. And so one should cultivate the soul and despise or keep under the body. The Corinthians had been influenced by this worldview and applied it to their Christianity, and they were seeing the meaning of Christian spirituality in terms of this pagan worldview. Stop depriving one another, he said. Except. And Paul here piles up words to express his hesitation. Amation, he says. That means unless, maybe, just perhaps. He really hesitates to agree here. Unless, perhaps, maybe. And he weighs this with conditions. Unless it is by mutual consent. It can't be unilateral. Both partners have to consent. And it has to be, second, for a suitable time. Only for a suitable time, that you may have leisure for prayer. And third condition, that you be together again, lest Satan tempt you for your lack of self-control. And this I'm saying by way of concession, not commandment. I am here agreeing with you. It is not Paul's idea that they be apart for prayer, but this is a reluctant concession he grants to them. I agree with you. If you insist on it, I'll grant it, and grant it reluctantly. But it's not a commandment. It's a concession to you. Verse 7, I am willing for all men to be as I myself am. The word thello does not necessarily mean it is my will that this be. It may be softer than that. I am willing. As in 1 Corinthians 14:5, Paul says, thello, I am willing for all of you to speak in tongues. It is not that he's saying, it is my will that all of you speak in tongues. Rather, I am willing for you to. I am willing for all men to be as I myself am. But there is a decisive thing which is to be considered about whether a man is to be married or not. But each one has his own gift from God. One this way and one in a different way. Whether a person is to be married or not does not depend upon his higher or lower spirituality. It depends rather, Paul says, upon his gift from God. One man has a gift from God to be content to live his life as a single person, if he does, fine. Another man does not have that gift from God. If he does not, then that man should be married. And he should not try to imitate Paul unless he has Paul's gift. And this agrees with what Jesus said in Matthew 19:10-12. His disciples said, it's expedient for a man not to be married. If it's so hard for a man to get rid of his wife, it's not expedient for a man to be married. And Jesus said, not everyone can receive this saying. That is, that it's better not to be married. But he said, only those who can receive it should receive it. So Paul says, it depends on a man's gift from God, not a matter of higher or lower spirituality. Now in verses 8 and 9, he applies this to the unmarried and to the widows in Corinth. Now I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good. It is good. He does not say it is better. Yes, it is a good thing. It is right morally for a man not to be married. It is not immoral for him to choose not to be married. It is a good thing for a man, for them, if they remain as I am. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry. If you don't have the gift to be content as an unmarried person, then you should marry. And marriage is the norm. There are some exceptions on the part of some people who have a special gift from God to be happy as a single person, but the norm is that people will be married. And Paul is urging the Corinthians to realize that. If they do not have self-control, let them marry. It is better. If this word has its force, his basic force of the root word, it means stronger. Moral is stronger. Kraton. It is not inferior. It is morally stronger for them to marry than to burn. Now, he is saying and insisting upon this fact, if you do not have Paul's gift, don't try to imitate Paul. It is morally superior to be married. If you do not have the gift to be content as an unmarried person. Now in verses 10 and 11, he quotes the substance of what Jesus had said during his public ministry on marriage and applies it to the married Christians in Corinth. Now to the married I give charge, not I but the Lord, that a woman, that a wife, not depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband leave his wife. The woman who departs from her husband has only two alternatives. Number one, she can remain unmarried, agamos, that is, without an additional marriage. She may not contract another marriage because she is already married and she remains married. Let her remain agamos without another marriage, or the only other alternative is let her be reconciled to her husband. And there is no other alternative which Paul gives. Now in the next section, 12 through 16, Paul speaks to those who have mixed marriages. They were pagans. They were married as pagans. And then one of them became a Christian. I think that must have been the way it was, because Paul counsels against a Christian marrying a pagan. They were married as pagans, and then one of them became a Christian. And now the question arises, can the Christian remain with that pagan? Or should the Christian depart? And Paul says, I say this to the rest, that is, to the rest of those with cases that I have not yet treated. I say, not the Lord, I say as an apostle of Christ, and give my apostolic ruling as an apostle, I have no word to quote from the Lord. If any brother has an unbelieving wife and she consents to live with him, let him not leave her. Here is the question that arose in this case. Is that pagan going to be willing to live with a Christian? Can the pagan tolerate living with a Christian wife? Now, Paul expects the Christian to be able to live with the pagan, because he expects the Christian to understand that marriage is a covenant, and in that covenant one binds his will through all time, through all change, to the other person. But the pagan does not understand that. And the question arises from the pagan, will the pagan give his consent to live with the Christian? Or will the pagan say to the Christian, you may not be a Christian, I forbid you to be a Christian. And if you become a Christian or remain a Christian, it will mean the termination of the marriage. If the pagan gives his consent to live with the Christian, then the Christian is to live with the pagan in marriage. And a wife who has an unbelieving husband and he is content to live with her, let her not leave her husband. That repeats what he has said above for the wife. And Paul then takes care of this matter that was disturbing to the Corinthians. They thought they would be contaminated by the marriage. And Paul says, no, the contrary is true. The pagan is consecrated in the Christian. The unbelieving husband is consecrated in the wife, and the unbelieving wife is consecrated in the brother. Else your children were unclean, but as it is, they are holy. Now, in 15, there is this parenthesis. A parenthesis set in the midst of Paul's encouraging the Christian to remain with the pagan. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. This doesn't mean that the unbeliever has already departed, already run off, and the Christian is left all alone. Korizetai is a present tense. I think it is a connative present. And it has about this force. if the unbeliever is pressing for a separation. A connative means that a thing is attempted or desired. If the unbeliever is pressing you for a separation, and he is putting pressure on you, either to change your Christianity or to dissolve the marriage, then let him depart. The brother or sister is not enslaved in such cases. As the Christian person is not a slave to the unbeliever, so that he has to renounce his faith in Christ to do what the unbeliever says he should do. In that case, Paul says, in the case of such pressure, Paul says, the Christian is to permit the unbeliever to depart, not to give in. But it's not desirable that there should be a separation. But is contrastive. It is not for. Some translations render it for here. Put for in the text, but there is no for. It's de. But it is contrasted. But God has called us in peace. And the peace to which he has called us is to live in the harmony of marriage, and the opposite is the polemos, the violent disruption of the marriage. He has called us not to disrupt the marriage, but to live within the harmony of marriage. And the reason is given, for what do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or what do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? There is a different interpretation given to these words. Some take it in this way. God has called us in peace. That means if there is a disharmony and if you are having family altercations, it is better to separate because God wants us to live in peace and not to be squabbling in the home. And then verse 16 is taken as support of that. For what do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? And this means, on this interpretation, you are to despair of converting your non-Christian partner. How do you know you can do it? Marriage is not a missionary institution. You do not know whether you can convert that person or not, so give up and permit the separation to take place. It would be very strange to represent Paul as counseling someone to despair in efforts to convert someone. That would be the first strange thing about this understanding. And in the other case, in the case of verse 15b, as I suggested already, you have de, but contrastive, not for, supportive. It's not desirable for you to separate. God has called you to live in marriage, in peace. And an additional reason is you stay with the pagan, for you may convert that pagan. And so save him. Now, the question, specific question we have to deal with here is the so-called Pauline privilege. Is Paul giving the right of remarriage here? There are those that answer yes, and one yes answer says this: we may assume that the unbeliever will commit adultery. It would be unthinkable that the person, that pagan departing, would not commit adultery. When we think about the conditions, the terrible, horrible conditions in Corinth, when we think about the sensualism that was there, it is very unlikely that this pagan would abstain from committing adultery. And if he committed adultery, then the person would be free to remarry, according to Matthew 19. But this overlooks something. It overlooks the pagan asceticism which was present in the Greek world. It was not all sensualism. There was a terrible and horrible sensualism in the Greek world. But it was not all sensualism. There was also an asceticism. And it is a very interesting thing that the sensualism and the asceticism grew out of the same basic idea. The body is the tomb of the soul. And some people said, if that is right, then what we are to do is to permit the body to do whatever it wants to do, and the soul will not be contaminated by it. Others, beginning from the same premise, said, what we are to do is to mortify the body, and we are to kill it short of actual suicide, so as to release the soul from the hold of the body. So both this sadistic sensualism and masochistic asceticism came out of the same root. Even Epicurus, the Greek philosopher, the founder of Epicureanism, recommended celibacy. And because he said, if you are married, you are tied to another person, and your happiness is tied to the other person, and it is not as easy for you to attain the Epicurean ideal, the philosophic calm that comes from a lack of attachment. It would be dangerous to assume that the pagan departing would commit adultery. It's always dangerous to make such assumptions. And one may not make such an assumption here. The second argument deals with chorizomai. Verse 15, if the unbeliever departs, chorizitai, let him depart. It is said that this word, chorizomai, is a technical term for divorce. And neither Jew nor pagan understood there to be such a thing as a divorced person who did not have the right to remarry. The right of remarriage, it is said, is inherent in this word chorizomai. If the unbeliever departs, that means the marriage is finally terminated, irrevocably ended. And because there is this divorce, then any Jew or any pagan would understand that there was a right of remarriage. And that's inherent in the word itself. Well, let's look at this. I agree that the word chorizomai may be used of divorce, but I question whether it is a technical term implying the right of remarriage. I believe it is not a technical term. And I believe verses 10 and 11 of this chapter show that. Somebody referred to an article I had written in the Spiritual Sword and said I just equated verse 15 with verse 11. That is not really what I did. What I did was to say that verse 11 shows that chorizomai, depart, the word translated depart, is not used as a technical term. Let's look at that. Paul says that the wife should not depart, choristhenai, the same word. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. Let her be reconciled to her husband who is not her husband any longer. If she departs with the right of remarriage, let her remain unmarried. And let her remain, or let her be reconciled to her husband. Now, does the word choriste here have its ordinary meaning, or is it a technical term? You judge that. If it is has its ordinary meaning, it simply means to keep apart. The wife is not to keep herself apart from her husband. But even if she does keep herself apart from her husband, she must not be remarried. What she may do is to be reconciled to her husband, to the husband to whom she is still married. In that case, the word charizomai is no more a technical term than it is in Philemon 5, verse 15, where Paul says of Onesimus, perhaps he was separated for you for a season that you might have him forever. Does it have that ordinary meaning, non-technical sense, or, and you judge, does it have this technical sense? Even if she is separated with the right of remarriage, let her not be remarried. But what she may do is to be reconciled to her husband, the husband that she has no more. And finally, now there is the word dedulotai. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, or as RSV translates it, bound. NEB says, under no compulsion. It is said that this word is not bound, means that the person is free from the marriage bond. That bond is the marriage bond. The person is free, and being free from the marriage bond, there can be a remarriage. James Buswell says it well. The words, the brother or sister is not bound in such cases, can have reference to only one bond, namely the marriage bond. The teaching is clear that desertion destroys the marriage bond. In Romans 7:2, the Apostle Paul describes the married person as free from the bond of marriage when the husband or wife has died, and he explicitly says, free to be married to another. Such is the only meaning which fits 1 Corinthians 7:15. But there is a problem with that. And the problem is that the words are different in 1 Corinthians 7:15 and Romans 7:2. In Romans 7:2, the word used is dedetai. That's a perfect from the word deo. The word deo means to bind or to tie. The word in Romans 7:2 means a moral constraint or moral bond. The wife is morally constrained. She has a moral obligation to her husband as long as he lives. But if he's dead, she's free. This same root is used in the same form also in 1 Corinthians 7:39. A woman is bound as long as her husband lives. But if her husband has fallen asleep, she is free to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. A dedetai, she has a moral obligation. There is a constraining tie that holds her to her husband as long as he is alive. But never does Paul use the word douloo of marriage. Douloo means to enslave. Marriage is not slavery. The wife is to be subject to her husband, but she is not his slave. And Paul never describes marriage in terms of slavery. But that is the word he uses here. The brother or sister is not enslaved. Ou dedulotai. And it's a perfect tense. That means not that he was enslaved but is not now enslaved. It means rather that the brother or sister has never been enslaved in such a case. There is no such slavery that Paul is here describing for the Christian. Paul says in Romans 6 that we are enslaved to God, that we are enslaved to righteousness. In 1 Corinthians 9, he said that he had enslaved himself to all men so that he might gain the more. But in 1 Corinthians 7:24, he says, do not be enslaved to men. Do not become slaves to men. For us to become slaves to men, in the sense in which Paul is speaking of in this passage, would mean that we do not have the free exercise of our Christian faith any longer. And Paul does not want us to enter that kind of slavery. He does use the word douloo of a number of things, but never does he use it of marriage. This would mean to doulotai of marriage, as Paul uses it here in 7:15, means that the Christian is not to consider himself subject to a pagan in any way that would deny him the exercise of his Christian faith. So, Paul says, to review briefly, verse 15, and this is a parenthesis. Set in this context in which Paul is urging the Christian to preserve his marriage to a pagan, if the unbeliever presses for a separation, then grant it. If he does not consent to live with the Christian, but is pressing for the separation, then you grant it, for you are not a slave. In such a case, you never have been, and never are to consider yourself such, because that would mean that you have to renounce your Christianity for the pagan. You are not to do this. Nevertheless, he says, breaking the marriage is not desirable. God has called us in peace. And remember this, you may save that person to whom you are married. I thank you very much indeed for your good attention for this discussion.